The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition, where on this show we're going to talk a little bit about a recent question that came in to our podcast here, and it turns out to be a good question for us to dive a bit deeper, as we usually do on the EDU shows versus the Q&A show. So even though this topic comes from a listener question, it's going to be pretty much the entire show talking about the ramifications of what they bring up related to, it turns out, an annuity that they have. So I've got Jim on the line since we're practicing social distancing. He's at home again calling in. So Jim actually has the question, and he'll fill us in on the details, but welcome everybody to the show.
Good morning. Actually, good afternoon almost, Chris.
Close. Is it? One more minute.
Morning or afternoon?
Oh,
yet?
They're just turned afternoon as you were talking there. So.
Good afternoon. This is Friday afternoon, listeners. April something.
Third.
Mm-hmm. And again, we're still, 2 weeks into this? 4 weeks? I don't even know. How long are we into this? Stay at home, don't do anything, don't breathe on anyone, talk to anyone. It's been
just
at least two weeks in Colorado, hasn't it?
I think it's just barely two, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like 2 years. Goodness. But we are practicing social distancing, so I am working from home today. So once again, I'm on the phone, and I know the quality of the broadcast might be suffering a little bit. But we're trying our best, and hopefully everyone will appreciate that and be able to keep listening to us. Today's topic does have to do with the coronavirus and the market correction, and I thought we could also use it because it's very poignant, very lengthy email, but it gets into, Chris, someone who purchased a variable annuity with an income benefit. The industry refers to those as a living benefit. And he has some questions for us on it, and I thought we could turn this into a teaching moment in the sense we can explain to our listeners how these annuities work, what's good about them, what we feel is bad about them, but how this gentleman, in our opinion, may want to look at this annuity with the questions he's asking us in the situation that he's in. So that's what we attempt or will attempt to do on this. As I get into his email and I start reading it, I'll pause and you and I will run off and start answering questions and then we'll get back to his email. I'm not going to read the whole email because it's very lengthy. I will end up reading the whole thing, but I'm not going to read it first and then try to answer the questions. I'll answer questions as we start getting through his email. But let's give our listeners a little background, Chris, on what this man purchased and what it's intended for and how, well, I'll share how I feel he probably got away from the reason he bought it. Whenever you and I, Chris, are doing a financial plan, we send people a workbook. We call it a budgeting guide, but it's really a workbook. That's what I tell everyone. You don't know what I tell people during those coffee and a second opinion calls, but I'll tell people that Chris wrote a workbook, and he'll call it a budgeting guide. He doesn't want people to think it's work, but I tell people behind your back, Chris, that it's actually a workbook.
Okay. I'm okay with that.
You're okay with that. But you call it a budgeting guide, and in that budgeting guide that they have to complete for us, we ask questions about what type of accounts they have. They don't have to get too deep into it, but what's one of the main questions we ask someone when they indicate they have an annuity?
Why did you buy it? Is one of the key questions.
That's, to me, the key question. Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, there's other questions we ask, but that's exactly where I was going with this. And for listeners who don't know, Chris had no idea I was going to ask him that. We do not enter into this with any type of pre-planned script. Actually, if you listen to our podcast from a couple of weeks ago, when I couldn't explain a simple concept, you know that this is a one-time recording we do off the top of our heads. But I knew Chris was going to answer this because that is the first question we care about when we see an annuity. We are not pro-annuity, nor are we anti-annuity. We feel annuities are a wonderful tool when used correctly, but not so wonderful a tool when used incorrectly. Mm-hmm. You're not going to use a hammer to bang in a tack, a thumbtack. And you're not going to use a thumbtack to hold up a 4-pound picture on your wall. You need the right tool at the right time. And an annuity is just a tool. But the first question we ask people, why'd you buy it? Mm-hmm. And I think, Chris, when I start reading through this email, keep that in mind. If this person was working with us, one of the questions that should be running through your mind, which I'm sure it will be, is why did you buy this annuity? Because what he's thinking of doing with it, or listing as one of his options that he could do with it, kind of gets away from why I think he bought the annuity. So what are these annuities with living benefits? That you can get them on a variable platform or a fixed platform. This gentleman, folks, has them on a variable platform. What does that mean real quickly? Variable platform, you take the money you put into the annuity and you get to invest it in what the industry calls sub-accounts. They look like a mutual fund, act like a mutual fund, often have the same names as mutual funds. But they're not mutual funds.
Right.
They're what is called a sub-account. They may be managed by the same company that manages a mutual fund version of that sub-account, but when they're inside the annuity, they're actually sub-accounts, and they have a fee structure different than the mutual fund itself that you might be able to purchase directly from the fund company. In other words, part of the money in the annuity is going where, Chris?
Part of it's going away in fees to the insurance company.
Exactly. The insurance company is getting some money on the sub-account in the annuity. So that's why they're called sub-accounts. They're not the actual mutual fund version, but they'll have the same name and be managed by the same manager for the same company. It's just the fee structure on those sub-accounts are different inside the annuity, and a portion of that fee is most likely being paid to the insurance company. I'm not passing judgment on that. It's neither good or bad. It's the way the industry works. The insurance company needs to make something, and they get a portion of the management fee. So on the variable structure, you get to actually invest in products tied to the market, if you will, and it can go up or it can go down. That's what markets do. On a fixed platform, it's a little different. This gentleman does not have a fixed one, but there are fixed annuities that will work in the same way. Some are indexed. I don't want to get too deeply into that. And others are just traditionally fixed, where you're going to earn interest, and your principal is fully protected. So on the fixed platform, you don't have to worry about the value of the product dropping. You might not get interest in a down market, but you won't lose principal. However, on the variable, you can lose principal. Now, you can earn a lot if the market is going up, and you often will earn significantly more than you would in the fixed product, but your money that you put in is exposed to market risk. Now, we said earlier, folks, these products have what is called a living benefit. Traditionally, when an annuity was created, it only had what was called a death benefit. In other words, if you died and your portfolio value or account balance was worth less than what you put in when you originally opened it, minus any withdrawals you might have taken from it, and you passed away, your beneficiaries would at least inherit back what you put in minus any withdrawals. Right, so, you put in $100,000, you took out $20,000 and you died, but the account's only worth $60,000 because it dropped. Your beneficiaries would inherit $80,000. You put in $100,000 but took out $20,000, that's $80,000. You died when it was worth $60,000, your beneficiaries would get $80,000. So pretty straightforward. That was called a death benefit. And about, goodness, Chris, I can't remember when, but I'm going to say 15 years ago, maybe a little bit more than that, insurance companies came out with what they called a living benefit. In other words, instead of having to die to get a benefit from these annuities, you just had to live, and they'll give you a benefit from the annuity. So a living benefit has all different kinds. We're going to talk about what this gentleman has, guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit. They're going to allow him to withdraw a certain amount from that annuity forever, as long as he lives, and if he takes out a joint payout with his wife for as long, or this gentleman I know is a man, I'm assuming he has a wife, I don't know, but he could have a wife or nowadays a husband, it doesn't matter. But if you have a spouse that you are going to tie the income to, they'll pay you for as long as both of you are alive. And they call it a living benefit because you're alive. And they call it a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit because they're going to allow you to withdraw a certain amount from the annuity, and they're only going to pay you from your cash, but as long as you follow the rules that they set and withdraw no more than what they tell you you can withdraw, and all of this is laid out in the contract when you buy it, this gentleman's benefit, Chris, is 4.25% that he can take out every year. And as long as he doesn't take out more than that, what happens if his account balance reaches zero? Because remember, at first they're only giving him his money. But what happens if he lives long enough and it reaches zero?
That's when the insurance backer actually kicks in, where the insurance company now is going to make those payments. That's the guarantee part. That's what they're guaranteeing, that you can continue to get these payments out, even if your money that's in there drops to zero, which of course it likely will as you're taking this money out. It is possible that you could have returns in these sub-accounts big enough that it takes a long time or maybe never runs out. But for the most part, these do run out because you're taking money out. And then also the fees are coming out of those accounts as well.
Perfect. Now, notice I said, listeners, if you were key, you heard me say he's allowed to take 4.25% out. But I didn't say 4.25% of what. Right. So let me walk you through the next step with these annuities. When you open them, let's pretend, Chris, oh, here we go, math. Math is what tripped me up last time. So hopefully you got your calculator ready. I'll try to keep it simple. Let's say he put a dollar in. We'll pretend he put $100,000. Well, $100,000 is too low. Let's pretend he put $500,000 in, Chris. I'll let you keep track of the math so I don't get all tongue-tied again.
Yeah, let me start making some notes here.
Okay. So follow how this works, listeners. Let's say he put, and he doesn't indicate when he opened this annuity. He does say he hasn't put money in for 5 years. So he had it for at least 5 years. He might have had it for 10, 15. I don't know. A lot of these living benefit annuities do allow additional monies to be put in. Some don't, some do. So I have no idea how long he had this annuity open, and it's kind of immaterial to what I'm trying to describe. But let's just say, Chris, he opened it 10 years ago, and he put $500,000 in. I'm just making this up, listeners. Mm-hmm. Follow how this works. Whenever you open one of these annuities with a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit, you will have two account balances that you can look at.
Right. And this is where the confusion starts on these. People don't get the difference between these two account balances.
Exactly, and it gets very confusing. You don't know how many people don't understand this. But follow along with this now. So he put $500,000 in. Mm-hmm. You will have two account balances. One is your actual account balance, mm-hmm. and another one will go by different names. But most assurance companies call it the income base. I call it, folks, you know me, I like to simplify things. Even though I go deep into these to teach you, I try to keep the concept simple. I call it a pretend account.
Yep.
And I wish insurance companies called it that, because too many people, Chris, think what with the income base?
That that's actually an amount that they have access to. It actually
exactly.
it is not. It's a phantom account. It's a number that's simply used for an additional calculation. That's what it's for. It's the number that other calculations are made from. It's not a dollar amount that you can take out.
Exactly. Now, the insurance company says they make that perfectly clear by calling it an income base, implying that it's only used for income purposes, which is true. And if you actually read the statements, they do list this is not available for withdrawal at any time. The problem is too many people don't read that. They just see the balance, or they misunderstand the brokers and agents and producers who sell these. I'm not saying the brokers, agents, and producers purposefully mislead people, but some people just don't follow these concepts. I'm not saying our listeners, because if they're listening to this podcast, they're do-it-yourselfers, and they're probably quite smart on investments. However, Chris, you know a lot of the Main Street public, if you will, they don't quite have a good understanding of finance, and it's very easy for them to be confused. And that's the people Chris and I are talking about. Maybe not so much listeners to this podcast, but your family and friends listeners who don't follow things like you might not quite understand the income base and their account balance. That's why I call it the pretend account. And I tell clients that. This isn't real. It's pretend. But why do you have the pretend account? Because the insurance company is going to say you've got your actual account balance, and that can grow or drop in a variable annuity. We don't know what it's going to be worth at the end of a certain period of time. And if it's on a fixed annuity, the fixed amount you can receive changes every year, so you don't know if you're going to get 3% or 6%. They'll tell you every year what it's going to pay, but you don't know what it's going to be. So you really don't know what your account balance is ultimately going to be worth. And then the pretend account, what's unique with that, though, folks, that's guaranteed. They are going to tell you what that pretend account is going to earn every year. Now, here's where it gets very, very confusing. Some will pay 5% simple interest. Others will pay 6% compound interest. I'm making these numbers up. They can be whatever your contract is. You've got to really pay attention. Is it simple interest or compound interest? But they will pay a set amount of interest or growth on that account. Some will pay it, Chris, forever. Others pay it only for a certain number of years. Some will guarantee that your initial pretend account balance, which equals the money you initially put in, will get to a certain level and then never grow anymore. In other words, some will say this annual return will continue until the pretend account or income base is worth 200 times what you put in, or 300 or 400. Every annuity is different, so you have to follow what that pretend account is going to grow and how long. And then every contract will have a withdrawal amount. This one, for this client, is 4.25%. No cost of living, he said, which is very typical. Very few of these products, if any anymore, allow that. So 4.25% of what, Chris?
That pretend account.
Or the account balance, whichever is
bigger,
higher.
Yeah, but in this, well, yeah, I'm jumping ahead. I know.
Yeah, jumping ahead.
I knew
ahead
in the
a
back
little.
Of my mind this one, the real account was lower, so that's why I said that.
Right.
But yes, if the real account is bigger, then you get the benefit of that.
So what the insurance company is telling you with these products, folks, is essentially the minimum amount, wow, try saying those two words fast together, the minimum amount of income you will receive at any given point. It's very easy for you to figure it out with this because you know the guaranteed growth of the pretend account. You know the guaranteed withdrawal amount. And when it comes time for you to turn the income on, this particular listener would be eligible for 4.25% of the pretend account or his account balance. It's as easy as that, folks.
Mm-hmm. And the attraction to it, what the people are hoping, of course, is that particularly in one of these variable chassis annuities, is that those sub-accounts are going to perform well enough where they grow, even though they're being leached away fees, of course, but net of that, they will grow and grow to a larger amount than that income base that is growing at their stated amount. So the minimum, of course, is that income base promised amount that was in the contract on the front end. But the hope, of course, and this is why they're being sold and get attractive to most people, is especially in this day and age when those guaranteed minimums aren't quite as attractive as they may have been in the past, they're hoping that variable sub-accounts will perform well, and then their income payment will be based upon that larger real account balance. That's the hope, right? But you have the fallback of the minimum, that pretend account.
Exactly. So that's the basics, folks, of how this works, how these products work. Now, a couple of my thoughts on them. They're okay. I'm not pro or anti. I liked them a lot better about 10, 12 years ago during what we call affectionately the living benefit price war. If you remember, Chris, back then, 10, 12 years ago, These living benefits were phenomenal. I've disclosed on this show many times I own one. I refuse to say the company because I don't want anyone to rush out and think, oh, this company, the one I own is not offered anymore. In fact, they offered it for less than a year before they closed it.
Before they realized what they were promising.
This was an amazing promise. Yeah. And if this product was still available, I would be recommending it to our listeners because the income benefit, the pretend account, grew at a very high rate. I don't want to say what because people are going to be jealous. But when I saw what they were guaranteeing, Chris, until I was 91, I could keep it till 91 before having to turn the income on. What they offered every year in growth on the pretend account, I felt to myself, there's no way you're going to earn that guaranteed in a risk-free investment account. So I bought one. I've told everybody on this podcast before. I own one. So I'm neither pro nor con on these. At a part in my life, I was very pro. right now, I don't feel a lot of the income benefit is worth it anymore.
And the reason we're talking so much about the income benefit, when Jim says he bought one because it was attractive in the numbers, but he also needs the income in the future when he can turn it on. If he wasn't using it as an investment vehicle.
Not at all.
It's a bad vehicle for that. Even though it had all these great income features, these are not good, efficient investment vehicles. It's not an investment at all, actually. Right?
I'm glad you put that in because I had forgotten to mention that. But Chris is 100% right, listeners. You don't buy these products with a living benefit as an investment. Thank you for mentioning that. Duh, I should have said that right off the bat. You buy them because you want the guaranteed income, and you need the guaranteed income. Right. That is key, and that is where I think our emailer, when we get to his email, might have made a mistake, Chris. I bought it because I've also told listeners to this podcast, I have a very poor Social Security benefit. Because I used to be a police officer that never paid into Social Security. And if I left the police force before serving 15 years, and I left after 8, I had to take my pension as a lump sum distribution. So I have a lot of my years of work never paid into Social Security. Then I started a company in Colorado when I moved, and I've talked openly on this show. Goodness, Chris, for the first 8, 10, 12 years, I don't even know how long, I barely made anything. So I have very little paid into Social Security. I'm paying in a lot now, but I have a lot of zeros, a lot of zeros. And I'm going to get a very poor Social Security benefit. And I have no pension benefit. And I have no wife to rely on maybe her pension and Social Security. So I needed more income, guaranteed income. And when I saw what this insurance company was guaranteeing, I can't remember if I bought it 10, 12 years ago now. It was a very long time. I bought mine. I bought one because I needed income. These products should never be purchased as an investment vehicle because they're not. You don't go to an insurance company to buy an investment.
Right. It's like taking a dump truck and trying to make it a race car. It's just so inefficient for purposes of investment performance. But it's great for hauling stuff, right? It's great for guaranteeing or generating income in certain cases, as long as the features are right for your circumstances. But it is not a good investment vehicle because of the inefficiencies inherent in the product itself.
Exactly. But now, folks, you have an understanding of how this works. Now, these annuities are rather expensive when they are on the variable chassis. Mine is on a variable chassis. When I bought mine, they didn't exist on the fixed chassis. Mine is a variable chassis, and the fees are quite high. My fees, folks, are north of 3% a year. Am I panicking over that, Chris?
No, because they don't come out of what he's worried about. What he's interested in is that income base, the growth of that income base, and the percentage that they promise to pay him from that income base. That's what he's worried about, and the fees don't come out of that part.
Nope. They come out of my money, folks. I have inside that annuity just about what I originally put in 10, 12 years ago. It hasn't really performed that well, especially lately with another big drop. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Because my pretend account has grown tremendously, guaranteed. I bought that product for the income I knew I was going to be able to generate between 60 and 70. Now it's between 60 and 65. I'm thinking of taking it out. But originally I was going to go to age 70. And maybe I still will. I don't know. I'm still 4 or 5 years from taking income out of that product. But I don't care what the account balance is worth, because when I put that money in, even though I have access to the money, it's not annuitized. I could close the deal and walk away with whatever my account balance is, and my account balance is barely higher than what I originally put in.
And they, when they sell them to you, they talk about that as a benefit, as something that would should make you feel better about buying it. That's where Jim and I think you should change your train of thought and not focus on that. Your focus should be on the other features, what's happening on the income promise side, because taking the money out is admitting failure, is essentially admitting that things just blew up on you and you're going to take your money out, tail between your legs, most likely having lost a bunch of money in fees compared to what you could have put that money into as an alternative. So taking the money out isn't something that should be focused upon, even though they tout that as some great feature of it. Trying to calm those who are nervous about giving their money to an insurance company, they always point out and emphasize, oh, you can take your money at any time once you're past. Usually there's a certain period where you can't take it, but beyond that, you can take the money out and walk away. And that's they try to calm your nerves about handing money over to an insurance company with that feature. That gets way too much focus by most people. Should be focusing on the income benefit, because that's the reason you should be buying these, is for the income.
Exactly. Thank you. Another excellent point, Chris. So I don't care about the fee, folks, that I'm paying. And I told you, it's a little north of 3%. Doesn't bother me at all. Because when I bought that, I knew, even though I could revoke the decision, in my mind, it was an irrevocable decision. I knew I was going to hold that, turn it on, and begin taking money out. And right now, if I turn the income on, Chris, at 60, it'll take me 6 years to withdraw out what I put in because of the outperformance of the pretend account relative to the benign performance over the last decade or so of the actual investment account. I actually bought this, I did the math in my head, 12 years ago now. If you look at what the equity markets have actually done over the last 12 years, it ain't that much, folks. And it's no way near what my pretend account was. And under the current withdrawal that I could take at 60, I'll get all my money back by 66. And if I live to 96, I get 30 years of more money than what I put in. Now, that's just how the product works. The fees, to me, are a red herring. To most of you do-it-yourselfers, you're going to fixate on the fees. You shouldn't, believe it or not, because you shouldn't buy this if you have any intention of taking the money out. If you view this as an investment, you were either sold a bill of goods you should have never bought, or you don't understand how the product works. It's not the fees. Your account balance is going to drop, and hopefully drop to zero, like mine will, essentially, after turning it on for 6 years, because now the insurance company has to pay me for as long as I live or as long as you live. And the reason I say the fees are a red herring is if it was purchased for an investment, yes, those fees are outrageous. But if it's purchased for a guaranteed growth, I won't tell y'all how much I'm earning on my pretend account, but it's a lot. And every year my income goes up by that much, Chris, because the account is guaranteed to grow by that much. Mm-hmm. My withdrawal percentage is fixed, but the pretend account grows every year. So every year I wait to take income, my income grows by that amount. It's not quite the 8% that Social Security gives you, but let me tell you, Chris, it isn't that far away from it. And that's how much my income is guaranteed to grow every year. So I don't care what the fee is, because I have no intention of closing that account and taking my money out as a lump sum.
Right, and so many people misinterpret.
I'm going to get my money out. Oops, excuse me, Chris. What were you saying?
So many people misinterpret the fee as eroding that income that they could get. It's not touching that. The fee is coming out of your actual account balance that's off to the side, which we've pointed out now isn't where your focus should be because you don't care about that. You're not going to be ever taking that out if you truly bought it for income. It's the income payment that isn't affected by the fees that is the focus.
Exactly. So my income payment, my pretend account, grows a certain amount every year. And by it growing, it increases my income benefit by that same amount every year. Every year I wait, I know my income benefit rises. So hopefully this listener purchased this annuity for the income benefit. But as I read through his email, you're going to see he may not have. And I think he might have been sold a bill of goods, but I don't think it is as bad as what he feels. And he gives three options in his email, Chris, of what should I do, this, that, the other thing. And he tells us, I think I should do this one. Number two is his. And I agree with him. I think number two is the one he should do. But we'll get to his email in a second. I just wanted people to have a good understanding of these products. Now, one thing also on the fees, because I think this listener grotesquely underestimates what he's paying in fees because he doesn't understand how the fees work. Yeah.
And this is the one that's going to blow everybody's mind. I know exactly where you're going with this.
Okay. Yeah. So there are three fees with these annuities, especially on the variable platform, folks. Three fees. Okay? The first is called the M&E fee, the mortality and expense fee. Everyone will have that. It's usually around 1 to 1.4 on most of these products. And that goes to the insurance company to help cover their expenses. Mortality and expense fee, usually around 1 to 1.4. Then you have the actual fees of the sub-accounts, the fees that the quote-unquote investments within the product are going to charge you. As I already said, the insurance company gets a portion of that as well. And if you read the prospectus that comes with the product, and it's about 90 pages probably, all of that will be listed in the sub-account prospectuses, what the fees are, and that the insurance company gets a percentage of it. Then there is the fee. It's called a rider fee, R-I-D-E-R, rider fee, and it references this income benefit, which is the reason you should have bought this product, not for an investment, for income. So this is called a rider fee. And it's usually, on most products, Chris, 1%. I've seen it as low as 8/10 to as high as 1.5. But it's usually about 1. But what's it 1% of, Chris?
This is the weird one. Even though the fees don't come out of the pretend account, this rider fee is 1% of the pretend account. So they're going to calculate it based off of the income base, but they're then going to turn over and subtract it from the account balance. So this is why Jim mentions that people underestimate the true fees that are coming out of their actual balance, their actual account balance, because if the account balance is lower than the income base, 1% of the income base is going to be a higher percentage of that lower account balance where it's coming out of. So if you're looking at the account balance as far as the relationship to fees, they're not lying by telling you, in this case, the 1% rider fee. It's true. It's just most people don't understand what it's 1% of.
And again, to me, it's a red herring.
Yeah.
Because I don't care what my account balance is because I didn't purchase it to be able to take the account balance out later. I purchased it because I personally need some guaranteed income. Goodness, our whole retirement plan, Chris, is based on covering our minimum dignity floor with lifetime guaranteed income. And I don't have any. I got a very poor Social Security benefit, and I don't even have a pension.
Which brings up a good point as to why Jim, as young as he was 12 years ago, was still interested in making a plan for his 60 or 70-year-old self to have income, and he committed to it way back then. This isn't something we recommend normally for people. Making a decision like this, which while technically is revocable that you could take the money out, but we've pointed out why you should consider it to be an irrevocable decision, because taking the money out is generally not going to end up well because of all these fees and performance issues, etc. Because you're making an irrevocable effective decision about something that is so far in the future, so many things might change, and we generally recommend you get a little closer to the need before you start committing to an irrevocable decision. People ask us all the time why we focus so much on very simple income annuities like single premium immediate annuities, which are the most simplistic form of income annuities out there. They're the original base, plain vanilla style that you can get, and not look at, say, deferred or something else where you buy it like this chassis, where you're going to then hopefully have some growth and income that reaches a certain amount in the future. But you had to make the decision so early. A lot of times the future is murky enough that you're not sure exactly what the situation is going to be, what your health situation is going to be, what your assets are going to be, maybe even what your expenses that you need to cover with this income are going to be. So that's why we generally prefer people hold on not making that irrevocable decision until much later, when they're far more confident that they need that. But in this case, the need was so obvious for Jim, because he has such a low Social Security benefit for the reasons he explained, combined with these almost borderline absurd promises that were made in this particular product that he owns, it was pretty much a no-brainer. There's every once in a while you'll see a circumstance that comes around where the planets align. He had a pretty well understood and defined need, combined with a tool that suddenly appeared for less than a year that was offered, that was seemed like a great tool, a fabulous new tool to meet that need, and he pulled the trigger. But this is an abnormal story that we're describing to you. It's not something you would typically do because of all of the possible unknowns and variability of life that could happen in another scenario. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. Thank you. Mm-hmm. It describes exactly what my situation was. So this gentleman feels his fees, Chris, are 2% in his product. I'm just trying to get him to understand he's probably paying even more than what he thinks.
Yeah.
But if he bought it for income, doesn't matter. I could care less, folks, if my fees doubled. Not that they could, but let's just say they doubled or tripled. Why do I care? My pretend account is growing at a guaranteed amount, and all's what it means is the less my actual account grows, the quicker it reaches zero.
And the insurance company then pays you instead of yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They have to pay me until I die. And depending on how long I live, and hopefully if I stay coronavirus free, it'll be a very long time, I might get 2, 3, 4 times what I put in. That's why I bought it. But anyways, I digress. So now you have a good understanding of how this works. Let's get to our listener's email and the situation that he's in. Okay, so he begins the email with, "Hi, Jim and Chris. So, is it go Bucks now?" We never got the sound of me crying my heart out.
I need to get that.
You never got the sound of that. For those who don't know, yours truly has been a diehard New England Patriots fan his entire life, and I had 20 great years with Belichick and Brady. And for some godforsaken reason, Brady did not sign again with the Pats, and he has gone to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for 2 years.
Well, the weather's
and
much
it wasn't
better.
Say what?
The weather's much better.
Weather's better. And it wasn't the 2 years, $50 million guaranteed. This guy, Brady, and his wife, Gazelle. Is it? No, it's not Gazelle. Gazelle's an animal.
Giselle.
Yeah. They make a boatload of money. It's not the $50 million. But anyways, he is not there. So this gentleman begins. So is it Go Bucks now? Actually, right now, this is funny. Y'all can't see me, and you can't see me, Chris. I have a T-shirt on that says Go Pats. So... no, it is not Go Bucks now. It is, in my eyes, it is still Go Pats. Okay. Hi, Jim and Chris, longtime listener, first time emailer from Arizona. Here is my situation. A decision was made recently that in the next couple of months, I am going to move. And again, he lists the name of the company he has his annuity with. I'm not. Let's just call it XYZ. I'm going to move my XYZ annuity held in an IRA with fees that are 2%. Now, listener, I think you're paying a lot more than 2. And I will say I know the company quite well that you have it with, and I can all but guarantee you you're paying more than 2%. But for the reasons we've already shared on this podcast so far, I don't care if you were paying 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. As long as you bought this for the income benefit, and I don't think you did. I think, listener, based on other things you write when we get to them, you might have been sold a bill of goods. But if you truly bought this for income, I don't care what the fee is.
Right.
It's what the income, the pretend account, the income guarantee is. That's what you need to be paying attention to. Okay, so I am going to move my ABC or XYZ?
XYZ what is the today.
Okay, I am going to move my XYZ IRA annuity count with 2% fees to an IRA at Vanguard that will have much less than 1% fee. But what is he not going to get from his account at Vanguard, Chris?
The income benefit.
Exactly.
He's bailing on the annuity because he's not moving the annuity itself over to Vanguard. Vanguard doesn't do that. So he's clearly bailing out, at least what he's proposing here is bailing out of the annuity, taking that actual account balance he has, which he is allowed to do, as we pointed out. That's maybe one of the selling points they used when they sold it. You can always take your account balance. You haven't irrevocably made a decision. That's what he's talking about doing here.
Exactly. So he says, and settle those funds in for a long life as a backup for life's needs later on. So let me again repeat that sentence because it was all broken up. The decision was made recently that in the next couple of months, I would roll over an XYZ IRA annuity with 2% fees to an IRA at Vanguard with less than 1% fees and settle those funds for a long life as backup for life's needs later on. Sounds to me, Chris, he's trying to position the annuity as a buffer, perhaps.
Yeah, as a cushion for the future. Changing its intended purpose in our mind, right? Because it's not... He's abandoning the income benefit here, and he's going back to just the lump sum cushion idea.
Exactly. He should have bought this originally for the income benefit. But if he's willing to move it now as a buffer... He used a dump truck as a race car,
right,
or a nail to drive a thumbtack. No, did I say that right?
That's about as good as anything.
All right. I think I know what
the
I meant.
Wrong tool. Yeah, the wrong tool.
No, I nailed it. No, I got it right.
Well, you wouldn't.
If the world's a nail, everything's a well.
Yeah, you threw the whole thumbtack in there and confused yourself.
Oh, the thumbtack, whatever. Yeah. I don't know what the hell I meant, but I think it makes sense.
I think everyone else understood.
Good, because I don't. Okay. However, as of my writing of this email, this corona upheaval has blasted my annuity account value, and I am now down 21%. So follow that, folks. His annuity's been nailed, as many portfolios have. He's panicking. I guarantee you, I already told you folks, I opened my annuity 12 years ago. The last time I looked, I asked Laura in the office to look, and she told me what the value was. That was November of last year. Market was still going up then, Chris, was it not?
Yeah.
Yep. And when she told me the value, I know what I put in. I said to myself, huh, I'm up barely, but I'm up. Do you think I'm up today, Chris?
Negative.
No.
No.
I'm not losing sleep over it, folks. I'm losing sleep over other things, but it is certainly not the value of that annuity. I have no intention of taking the money out. Now, this man does. He's thinking, I'm going to take this money out and essentially make it a buffer. Now, in his particular case, if he needs a buffer, he may have to take it out. But I don't feel he should, and I would be very cautious on that, because he's giving up all the growth of his pretend account and the guaranteed income. And he knows this because he continues, Chris. But because this is a guaranteed annuity based on the amount in the account as of my birthday, and to lock in the annuity for taking distribution values, my account hasn't lost anything. What he's saying there, folks, because it's not very clear,
Yeah. The
annuity that he has will lock in his account balance every year. And if it is higher than his pretend account, which is growing at a guaranteed rate, that becomes the new value of his pretend account.
Right.
So I think what he's saying here is, hey, my pretend account, my income base was locked in.
Mm-hmm. And hasn't gone down with this.
And hasn't
drop.
Gone down. Mm-hmm. Right. And it appears that this insurance company locks it in on the value on his birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Which I find odd. Most of them lock it in on the value of the anniversary. Now, maybe it just so happens he opened the annuity on his birthday, or perhaps this annuity does lock it in on your birthday.
Mm-hmm.
But
they could pick any day.
Anything is possible.
Yeah.
So what he's saying, folks, essentially in English is, hey, I still got this pretend account, and I haven't lost anything in that. But I've lost 21% since this corona upheaval on the money that I have access to. So he continues, Chris. The way I see it, I have three options. One, cash out the annuity to get out from under these high fees and roll the money to an IRA, as I already said. Let's pause on that, Chris. What do you think of that idea?
Well, he's going to basically give up on the annuity. He's gonna surrender, essentially, wave the white flag and say, even though I've taken it in the shorts and I've with this 21% drop and I've been paying all these high fees that have eroded that account balance, that real account balance over this time, I'm just gonna call it all off and take my money to Vanguard and hope for the best moving forward and try to forget my whole experience with this annuity. That's my long description of what he's doing with his first choice.
Exactly. I mean, you hit the nail on the head, and I will tell you, listeners, I don't like that idea. He should have never bought this as an investment. If you wanted an investment, you should have went to Vanguard, which is an investment company. Don't go to XYZ Insurance Company, which is an insurance company. It's, again, like going to a Ford dump truck dealer to buy a race car. You went to the wrong place. If you want a race car, go to a Ferrari dealer. There was a Ferrari in front of me yesterday. That car just looked wicked fast.
Yeah.
It just, have you ever seen one of those things?
Oh, yeah.
My gosh. This thing looked like if he pressed the gas, it would have just went like a rocket.
They look fast,
but anyways,
and still, yeah.
It was a black Ferrari in front of me and birthed it, of all places.
Nice.
But anyways, I digress. Okay, so we don't like option one. Now, that said, We're not telling you, listener, not to do that.
It is an option.
It is an option. We're not disputing that. It's not out of the three options you list that you are considering, I would have to say I'm not a fan of that one. Because I would hope you bought that annuity for the income benefit, like I did. And you would be giving up that income benefit if you move the money. So that's why we're not very big fans of that. And by your own admission, your pretend account hasn't budged. That's the whole idea of the pretend account. That's the guaranteed income side. Okay, option two. I could lock in the annuity with the negative 21% figure, but start taking distributions from my, he doesn't mention it, but I'll say pretend account, this July when I turn 59 and a half so I don't get a 10% early withdrawal penalty. Remember, listeners, this money is in an IRA. So what he's saying, Chris, is my pretend account didn't drop 21%. Mm-hmm. It's still up there.
Yep.
I could turn the income on in another couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen to his account balance when he takes the income now?
It's going to start to drop because they're going to start to give him, at first, they're technically giving him back his own money that's in that real account.
Exactly. So they're going to give him, he's allowed 4.25%. I can't do the math in my head, but he's allowed 4.5% of his pretend account. Maybe his pretend account now, if he's had this annuity for over a decade, maybe it's doubled already. Maybe it's worth, if you put in $500,000 in my hypothetical example, maybe it's worth $700,000 by now, $800,000. Maybe it doubles after 10 years. A lot of them will double after 10 years. I don't know. But 4.5% of something that's a lot higher than the original $500,000 he put in. His $500,000 might be worth only $300,000 now in my hypothetical example. I don't know if the guy put in $500,000 or not. But 4.25% of $700,000 is a hell of a lot more if the account balance is only worth $300,000. Follow what I'm trying to say, listeners? So his withdrawal percentage might be worth a lot more than 4.25% because you get the withdrawal from your actual account. So his balance is going to start dropping even faster. It's going to drop because of the fees, which are probably close to 3%, and he doesn't realize it. It's going to drop from the fees. It's going to drop from the cost of the subaccounts, and it's going to drop from the performance of Wall Street, which has been abysmal and may continue to be abysmal for a little while as we battle corona.
And in this case, with since Jim threw out some numbers, if that pretend account had grown to the 700, if he gets to take 4.25% of that, that's almost $30,000 per year. That's going to come out of what Jim mentioned was the hypothetical, what we were kind of using as our example, pretending like the guy's actual account had dropped to $300,000. That's 10% of that actual account that he's getting because the withdrawal minimum is a percentage of the pretend account, which has not dropped.
But the money comes from your actual account, which has dropped.
So it's going to start draining that account pretty quickly in this example. Whenever the actual account balance is much lower than the income base balance, that pretend account balance, the dropping due to withdrawals from your actual balance is going to be quite fast on top of all the fees.
Exactly. But listeners, understand what Chris and I are saying. That's not a bad thing. Because when that account balance reaches zero, and if you're taking 10% out a year as a withdrawal, the insurance company's taking about another 3 as fees,
yep.
And who knows what Wall Street is doing. But if you're taking 13% a year out of something, it's going to be zero pretty damn fast, right. Is it not, Chris?
Yeah, unless there's amazing performance in those sub-accounts, it might be gone in 7 years.
Who cares, listeners and listener who sent this email? Because now you're only 59 and a half, even, let's call it 60, even if it reached zero by 67, if you still live another 10, 15, 20, 30 years, that's all from the XYZ right. insurance company.
They keep getting that $30,000 every year thereafter, and it's the insurance company who's on the hook for paying you that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, your number two idea of turning on the income intrigued me.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like that.
Now, he didn't give us enough specific numbers to be
right.
more confident in this, but that's certainly at its face, particularly when he's the actual balance of his account balance must be quite a bit lower, or he wouldn't be so worried about it and write us this email. So I suspect that actual account balance is down a lot from his birthday income-based pretend account balance. Otherwise, he wouldn't really be bringing up number two.
Exactly. And if he's looking to build a buffer, and this money is in an IRA, which it is, he starts taking this money out. Yes, he has to pay taxes on it, but every distribution from an IRA is taxable.
Mm-hmm.
He can start using that money, if he doesn't need it, to build his buffer. He's just transferring money from an always taxable account to a never taxable account, which will give him a lot of flexibility in the future, because longtime listeners know Chris and I like people to have money in always taxable IRA and 401ks, maybe taxable bank and brokerage accounts, and never taxable Roth accounts.
And that's that part Jim technically skipped over, is in this, for it to be in a never taxable account. The distribution out of there, when he got that, he treated it as a Roth conversion and got it in a Roth. If he just took it out and put it in a brokerage account, then it's in a maybe taxable account.
Correct. Now, you could, like Chris said, because he's only 59 and a half, start taking that money out, it's a withdrawal, and move it into a Roth as a conversion, which is a much better idea than mine. Thank you for pointing that out, Chris. I would not just put it in a maybe taxable account.
Right.
I would put it in a Roth. You
right.
got to take it out, put it in a Roth as a conversion. The tax implication is the same. His option two is turn on the income and start taking it. We'll just move it right to a Roth as a conversion.
Mm-hmm. Then future taxes are eliminated with a qualified withdrawal. So you don't, if you put it in a brokerage account, then you're exposing it to future taxes in the form of, you know, dividend interest, capital gains, those sorts of things. You can eliminate
right.
that
no,
if it's
no.
in the Roth.
Hands down, yeah. yours is a much better idea than mine was. I usually
well,
pick
I think
up
your mind
those.
Was going that way because you said it was going to end up being in a never taxable account.
Oh,
so I think
so,
half of your mind went that direction.
So my mind thought it, but yeah. my mouth didn't say it.
You just didn't blurt out the word Roth. I just wanted to make sure people were clear on that piece.
Thank you. But I see where we're going with this, listeners. And listener who sent the email, you're going to get, and here's the great thing, Chris. Even when that IRA reaches zero and there's no money in it, folks, it's still considered coming from an IRA.
Yep.
You can still convert it into a Roth even though there's nothing there to convert.
Yeah. You're converting the insurance company's money.
It's still considered from an IRA. Look at the brilliance of that. It's still an IRA, even though there's no IRA left because there's no money in it. And he's allowed to age 72 to delay IMDs. Now, once he reaches 72 and the account balance is zero, can he still do that, Chris?
No.
No.
No, because he's going to, the first out is going to be RMD.
Right. Once the annuity, we talked about this on the podcast in the past, folks. Once his annuity reaches zero,
right.
it is now considered a defined benefit plan,
right.
not a defined contribution plan. In other words, defined benefit plan rules apply. And once the account balance reaches zero, it would be considered an RMD. Now, I have to think, now as I talk about this out loud, even though he's not, that's a good question where I'm going with this in my head. He's not subject to IMDs yet, but would the defined benefit rules automatically kick in? Let's say it reached zero at 67, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Is that now considered an RMD? I don't think so, because it's still a withdrawal.
Unless it's considered, do they consider it annuitized when the balance hits zero?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. So we might have created an example where we should have thought about that gap between 67
and 72. Well, we're thinking as we're talking.
Yeah.
What we're going at here, listener, be very careful. My original thought that you could keep converting when the balance reaches zero. What happens to these annuities is defined benefit rules apply. And that simply means the money you receive out of the annuity when you are subject to required minimum distributions will be deemed to be the required minimum distribution of that account. So what I don't know is prior to reaching 72, will the IRS just consider that a withdrawal? Or when the balance reaches zero, even if you're younger than 72, they're going to consider it an RMD. You're not subject to RMDs until 72. So part of me says he might be able to do that. The other part of me says I'm not 100% sure. I would need to counsel not only with the slot group. This is a Natalie Choate question, Chris, because she's the one who points this out all the time in her writings, that once these annuities reach zero, defined benefit rules apply. And what I don't know is, will the tax code consider the distribution an RMD even when you're not subject to RMDs, or are they going to consider an RMD only after age 72?
I bet they consider them 72T payments.
Substantial equally payments until IMDs
like
begin.
That could be possible. Yeah.
So I'm not 100% convinced, listener, you can or can't continue to move it to a Roth as a conversion.
What I do know is
after age 72, you cannot.
No.
Prior to 72, you might. Hey, chances of being audited on this are slim to none. But I'm not 100% certain. I do know the people to counsel with to find out their thoughts, but interesting how we went down this little bit of a rabbit hole right now. But the point is, I like the idea of turning it on. I like the idea of moving it. He clearly doesn't need the money. Moving it to a Roth every year, you're going to have to pay taxes on it anyways. And until it reaches zero, which could take 6 years, 7 years, who knows, but it will reach zero. Until it reaches zero, keep funneling that into a Roth. After it reaches zero and before 72, gray area. I think you could go either way. And I would still be comfortable moving it to a Roth personally, but I'm not 100% sure. After 72, no more moving it to a Roth. It is definitely considered an RMD at that time. Okay, so that was the second option. Third option. How about I leave everything where it is and let the account slowly crawl its way back up in value and cash it out or lock it in for income later? Yes, you could do that. However, I got news for you. With about 3% in fees coming out and a 21% drop in value already, the likelihood of that account getting back to where it once was has a massive headwind because losses are not equal. A 21% loss doesn't mean you need a 21% gain to break even. You probably need closer to 30%, 28, 29, 30, somewhere around there to break even. Plus 3% a year in fees, it's going to take a long time to get back to its old high. Now, the good news is, your pretend account would still be growing and your income is still going to be valuable, but you're going to be faced with the same thing, paying 3% a year in fees, and then you're going to walk away because you get back to some arbitrary account value that you once had. What do we always say, Chris, about account balances? It's not yours. It was just a snapshot in time of what you would have had you sold. You never sold. That money was never yours. Stop fixating on what the account was once worth if you cashed it in on that date. Fact of the matter is, you never cashed it in, but it was never yours. Stop thinking of it that way with any investment. And this shouldn't have been sold as an investment. It should have been sold as income. But these people, Chris, who fixate on what they would have had at some arbitrary point in time, and they pretend that that was my money, it never was until you, quote-unquote, realize it. Why do you think the government calls it unrealized gain? It ain't real. It's what you would have had. Only when you sell it do you actually, quote, realize what you have. It's pretend. It's smoke and mirrors when it's invested. Stop fixating on that arbitrary amount like it's some magic number you have to get back to. But even if you did listen or do that and you got back to it, you're still going to have a pretend account with a balance significantly higher, right, Chris?
Absolutely.
And you're going to be faced with the same question. Do I walk away with this or do I take the income benefit? You're still going to have the same question. The dollar amounts are just going to be bigger and your life expectancy is shorter now. And you might not live long enough now to watch that account reach zero. Don't you understand the brilliance of what you purchase, listener? You seem to think you purchased an investment. You didn't. You purchased an income stream. The game now is to live long enough that you get all your money back, and then some. And that's your true return from this product. So the sooner you turn the income on, the sooner you get positive. And you're not positive until you receive all your money back. Now, insurance companies trick you, Chris, into thinking the longer you wait, this pretend account keeps growing. This pretend account keeps growing. Why are they doing that? They don't want you to turn on the income, do they?
Right, right. Because then you get closer to death when they don't have to pay anymore.
Exactly, because all initial payments are just a return of your money, folks. Y'all think the game is to die with money in this account. It's not. The game is to die with nothing in the account and years of receiving the insurance company's money. That's why I am rethinking my strategy. I was going to wait to 70, Chris. Why? It was just an arbitrary number. I was going to turn it on as a substitute to Social Security. But I'm thinking of turning mine on at 60 as well. You can probably guess mine's in an IRA as well. And I just chose 60 instead of 59 and a half. But I'm thinking of turning mine on earlier, even though I'm going to get less, because I want to get my money back. And I want my account balance to reach zero. But I'm not going to willy-nilly run into that. I don't know if I'll turn it on at 60. I have to look at my life expectancy and my projected expenses, because every year I wait, I do get significantly more, listener, than 4.25. So for me, it's a little different. And maybe I'll go to 66, 67, 68. It's not like Social Security, where I'm trying to get an age 70 benefit to the largest amount because I'm married and I want to make sure there's a big spousal benefit. I am a single man. And when I'm dead, there ain't no one else. I got no kids, no wife. So me dying with money in that account is not a winning strategy. So I'm looking at things a little different, but you, listener, have to look at your entire situation. But I'm not a big fan of option three, you trying to get back to this arbitrary dollar amount thinking you're coming out ahead.
Right.
You'll be paying 3% a year, in my opinion, 3% a year for something you're not going to keep. It makes no sense. So he continues, my take on all my options. Option one, cashing out now and just moving it to Vanguard when I'm down 21% from what I put in makes no sense, even though it will get me out of these outrageous high fees. There he is again, Chris, fixated on the fees. I agree with him, though. That is a horrible choice. Do you agree?
I don't think it's good. Yeah, I'm not attracted to one.
Okay. Number two, I really feel this is my silver lining choice. The market drop is one of the reasons I got into this account in the first place.
Right.
I can lock in my distributions, which haven't dropped, and build up our cash reserves slowly. I can also reduce future RMDs on this account. No, you can't, listener.
Well, all right, because
no,
he's going to be
reducing
continuing to get it, because it's
RMD.
Not like he's going to drain it to zero, because once you get to RMD age, the actuarial value of those future payments is deemed to be the RMD, which essentially on a qualified annuity, then the payment becomes the RMD.
Right.
So it's all RMDs at that
you
point.
You are not reducing your RMDs.
No.
But you're locking in guaranteed income, and that's what you want. So he says, reduce future RMDs. No, that's not going to happen. And add additional guaranteed income. That is true. You will add that. I really like number two, listener. I think you answered your own question. Number three option, leave everything as is and get back to this arbitrary value. Currently, this equates in dollars to $90,000 loss. How long, if ever, is it going to take me to recoup this? Which is exactly what I just said.
It's going to take too darn long, and you're going to give up all those years of income, likely to never have it increase because of that birthday measure of that actual account balance. You're likely to not get back, and that's where these sometimes this decision to turn on the payments earlier than you did before, because once you realize that the likelihood of increased payments in the future is very, very low because of the damage the actual account values have taken in this drop, that should swing your attractive, you know, the attractive meter over more towards number two, that income that's coming in, because it doesn't have a chance to grow much anymore. Back when it could grow, there was a good reason to delay. But now that it's likely not to grow much, if at all, that's what swings the pendulum more towards turning on the income now versus later. Because if it's not going to grow, every month you give up a payment, every year you give up a payment is just money lost.
Exactly. So he begins, this drop is $90,000. We could probably figure out how much money he originally put in, but it doesn't matter. How long, if ever, will it take to recoup this, all the while I am paying the very high 2% fee every year? Again, listener, you're paying a lot more than 2%. I can guarantee you that. Second, it's a red herring. Who cares? Right. I like option two, and I told you that at the start of this podcast, Chris. Option two, I think you would like as well. Mm-hmm. He's answered his own question. He called it the silver lining. Hey, my account balance dropped $90,000, but my pretend account didn't budge. He gets 4.25% of his pretend account. That might represent 6, 7, 8% of his real account. He's never going to get that withdrawal percentage anywhere else at age 60, 59 and a half. And it continues forever. And we feel very confident. In fact, I know for certain, as long as there is an account balance in that account, you can move that distribution into a Roth. The question mark is from the period of time it reaches zero and 72, can you still move that to a Roth, or is it technically your RMD at that point, even though you're not RMD age? But guarantee you, once you hit 72, and if the account balance is zero, and I pretty much all but guarantee you it will be by 72, you cannot move it to a Roth, but you can move it to a regular brokerage account. So I think he answered his own question there. But then in closing, because I know we got to wrap up, he says, just a little more info on me in case you're curious. I haven't put any money in this annuity for 5 years and don't plan on putting any more in. I guess this annuity is what it is. I am age 50. Where is it? I turned 59 in January, and my wife, who is younger, will be 56. We have no kids. It appears our minimum dignity floor will be taken care of by a combination of two excellent government pensions and two near full Social Security benefits. Let's pause there, Chris. At face value, do you think this man needed this annuity when he originally bought it?
Since this type of annuity is attractive for its income benefits, he doesn't, in our approach, doesn't need this extra income. Now, if he's taking the approach where he wants to cover all possible expenses with secure income, which is different than our approach, maybe there was justification for generating this extra income from this income annuity, this living benefit from this income annuity, or this variable annuity with the rider on it. So there could have been an argument at the time, but if he's attracted to our philosophy, which is he clearly is listening to our verbiage, the minimum dignity floor, if two nearly full Social Security benefits and two substantial government pensions, I have never seen people that had that combination of Social Security and pensions that didn't have an overabundance of secure income to cover their minimum dignity floor. In other words, they had way more income coming in than their minimum dignity floor justified, which means that income is going to be spent on fun stuff, which isn't necessarily bad, but the last thing they likely needed, if they're using our approach, is more income on top of that. They already have too much, based on our philosophy. He bought more. So probably when he bought it, he hadn't listened to our approach, or at least come around to being attracted to our approach. But he's got more income than he knows what to do with, probably.
Probably. And he referenced he bought it for the protection. So he bought it for the protection of the income base, yet he's fixated, Chris, on the account balance and the fees. He should be fixated on the income base and patting himself on the back. Our point is, listener, you might not have needed, technically speaking, additional guaranteed lifetime income with two good government, federal government pensions and Social Security. Very few times have we ever seen someone, in fact, never have we ever seen someone with two government pensions and two Social Security benefits not be able to cover their minimum dignity floor. You are going to be blessed, listener. It's what we call in the office a unicorn. You might be in a situation where all your minimum dignity floor is covered and perhaps a good chunk or all of your fund spending between this annuity and your pension and Social Security. If all your expenses are covered with lifetime guaranteed income between a pension, Social Security, and income annuity, we call that a unicorn. And it's a wonderful thing to be a unicorn because it means you don't have to worry about all the crap going on in the stock market. So even though you might not have needed to purchase this annuity, don't start thinking this annuity failed you because it's now worth $91,000 less than what you put in. You already said to us in your additional information about you that you bought this for the benefit, the guarantee. Well, the only thing that's guaranteed in a variable annuity, folks, with a living benefit is the living benefit. The income, your account balance is never guaranteed. If you were looking to guarantee your account balance, listener, you should have purchased the same type of annuity, but on a fixed chassis. Because not only would you have had the income benefit, you would have had an account balance that never dropped. But the fact of the matter is, you didn't. You have one whose account balance dropped. But you even said to us in the additional information about you that you put in your email, you bought it for the guarantee. The only guarantee you bought it for was the living benefit guarantee. So you recognize in the back of your head that's what you bought it for, but the very thing you bought it for is the thing you're chewing it apart for. Those high fees. Well, nothing in life is free, and those benefits cost money. Yet now you're chastising the annuity for having fees for the very benefit you're admitting you bought it for. Don't tear the annuity a new one. It doesn't need it. It did what you bought it for. When anyone, you listener or any listeners, buy these guaranteed living benefits, you should be kissing that money goodbye. And the ability to access your money to me is a red herring. The only time you would do that is if, God forbid, you lose in life. What do I mean with that? You no longer have a long life expectancy. And you're expected to die before the entire account balance is returned. So you're going to take everything out, perhaps, and spend it on your care, or enjoy a bucket list item before you die. The guaranteed income is no longer important to you. But other than that, whenever you buy these annuities, it's because you feel, like I did, I needed additional guaranteed income. But I don't look at my account balance. It took me asking Laura, one of my admin staff, hey, what do I have in my XYZ annuity? She had to look it up and tell me, because I don't even turn on account statements, Chris. I literally don't. They're available to me online, and I don't log in to see it because it's immaterial to me. I know what my withdrawal percentage is, and I know every year what my pretend account grows at. And that's all I care about. That money is lost to me. It's like I'm estranged from it. It's like people who get estranged from their children. You are dead to me, they say, to someone bad, or perhaps to an ex-spouse. It's like you don't exist. Stay out of my life. I want nothing to do with you. That's what I said, Chris, to the money I put into my annuity. You are dead to me. I don't care about you. I want the income benefit. Anyways, I thought this was an interesting topic. Hopefully our clients did. Our listeners did. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think we've covered practically everything regarding this particular situation, and we're getting close to the longest EDU show ever. So,
oh, wow. So let's wrap up.
Probably a good idea.
All right, listeners, hopefully you all found this interesting. I did. That's why I enjoyed doing this one and learned something. These products are very unique, very specialized, and they could fit in certain situations. If you have one, don't be so quick to take it out to the woodshed. Really look at it and ask yourself, why did I buy this? And you might actually appreciate what this product is doing, even though your account balance is down because of Wall Street and these outrageously high fees that you keep hearing about.
And if it turns out you think in hindsight you made a bad decision getting it, don't make another bad decision by doing something rash now. Really reanalyze the situation now that you have it and make sure you make the best choice. Don't just pull the plug hastily because it's possible that what you bought into and what they might pay you in future promises might be worth more than just pulling the plug on it right now. So reassess things. Even if in hindsight you've decided you want to get out of this deal, it isn't what you wanted anymore.
Exactly. All righty, listeners. Well, I'm going to let Chris wrap up the show. It's been a pleasure. We will chat with you again next week when we record again remotely as we continue to practice social distancing. I want everyone to stay safe in these trying and difficult times. and recognize we are here to help, even though we are pausing the acceptance of new clients. We still answer questions on the podcast. Chris will explain to you how to reach out to us. And the good news is we are hiring new staff. We've got hopefully some new people also coming on in addition to the recent new people we've hired. And we hope to be able to unpause in the not too distant future. And maybe if anybody needs assistance, Chris will explain that. You might be able to get to us sooner than you thought. But anyways, I'm going to turn this over to Chris to summarize the ending, and I will chat with everyone next week.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Yep.
So if you do want to learn more about us, you can go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, not only can you learn more about us and our approach and who we are, our backgrounds, etc., you can also submit there a question to us. Depending on the nature of the question, we might do what we did today, which is turn it into an opportunity to educate on a particular somewhat narrow topic. We kind of harped on one particular thing here. We also have a Q&A show you're probably aware of. On that show, we answer more individual focused questions rather than taking a long time to educate on something. I think you'll find most of the answers on the Q&A show to be pretty educational anyway. But usually on the Q&A show, we'll try to answer three to five questions every show of a variety of topics. So that's why those shows are a bit different than the EDU shows, which this is an example. So we want to thank everybody for continuing to listen. Go to jimhelps.com if you'd like to submit a question to us or learn more about us. And in the meantime, stay safe, and we'll talk to you next week. Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.